Mr. Whittle, you want reserved time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I ask to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
You may proceed when ready.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Ian Whittle. I have the pleasure of representing Ian Hughes in this appeal. Judge, I'm going to present to you what I hope is a more straightforward argument than previous I was listening was
completely. We won't award you any spousal support or equitable distribution, rest assured.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judges, this was granted on two assignments of error. The first was whether a motion in limine was ruled on correctly or not ruled on at all. And the second was whether there's sufficient evidence to support each one of these charges. I'll begin with the first assignment of error. In a motion, the court derives its authority to hear pretrial motions from the Supreme Court rules 3, 9, A through C, and it defines two different types. The first is a constitutional type. These are your motions to suppress, your double jeopardy motions, and those must be filed within 7 days of the court, within 7 days of the trial. And the 3, 9, B says that there are, in additional ones, any defense or objection that is capable of being of determination without the trial of the general issue may be raised on a motion before trial. Failure to present any such defense or objection before the jury returns a verdict shall constitute a waiver.
Does the statute require, the rule require, that the judge rule on those issues prior to trial?
The statute requires that the court can, if they are able to rule on them, to do so.
I mean, trial courts, in my experience, particularly when there's a jury sitting in the box and a defense attorney comes in with a motion like this, that is going to require some evidence to be presented, the trial judge says, I'm not going to deal with this right now. We're going to move on with trial. I'll deal with it when the evidence is offered by the Commonwealth. Is there anything wrong with the trial court doing that?
It depends on how the trial court does it, Your Honor. I think that if the trial court says, I deny your motion for now, but I'll deal with this when it comes in front of me, that's fine.
Okay. So in this case, the judge did make a ruling on the admissibility of the evidence. He held it to be admissible without objection by the defendant. Why doesn't that make this whole argument moot?
Because it was raised beforehand and it should have been ruled on initially. So,
well, what's the harm with the trial judge waiting until the evidence is actually offered?
The harm was that it was never ruled upon, Judge.
So it was. There was no objection and the trial court said admitted.
When the motion in limine was presented, Judge, it was not ruled upon. The court stated an erroneous standard. It says, I understand that this was not filed 7 days beforehand. This is not one involving the Constitution. Nevertheless, I'm not going to entertain this motion. So the court can say, granted, or denied.
But you effectively withdrew the motion when on page 280 of the appendix, you said no objection. Doesn't that withdraw any objection to the admissibility of the evidence?
I don't believe so, Judge, because the initial presentation of this motion was not ruled upon. So I think that in a perfect world, it would have been renewed. However, it was brought properly before the court, and the court didn't make a ruling. I think that is our first assignment of error, is the court could have said denied, and I'll hear it later, or they could have said granted, the motion's out, or the evidence is out.
It's actually pretty confusing what the court said, because the court said, well, this came too late, etc., but then goes on to say, basically, you want to keep certain evidence out. I think it's going to be a matter for the trier of fact in this particular case, which is the jury, to make the determination if the Commonwealth proved or their case or not. And by that I mean, if they prove it happens to be the weapon that was found, I believe it is home, blah, blah, blah. If they don't, the Commonwealth hasn't proved it, then it's matter for the trier of fact. Is that not a ruling, that it comes in for whatever weight the trier of fact might give it?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it is because of the next line, which says, the court says, all right, so the motion at this time will not be heard. So he doesn't say granted or denied. He says the reason why he's not going to hear, but he doesn't give us a proper ruling. So
I go back to what I was saying. I agree with your argument, actually, that this is not a motion that must be filed 7 days in advance. I agree with you there. I'm not sure the trial court was obligated to hear it that day. But even if it was, it seems to me that any error that occurred there becomes harmless when the exhibit is ultimately admitted without objection.
I think because it was raised beforehand, Judge, it should have been ruled on, and that's why it was not harmless.
Suppose we say, well, it's admissible. Wouldn't that be harmless error? So the trial court, assuming without deciding the trial court erred in failing to rule on the motion, the evidence is clearly admissible because da-di-da-di-da.
If Your Honor rules that it is admissible, then it would be harmless error, but it's not admissible because of the following reasons. The court ruled that, or the court let in this gun. This was a gun that was found several months after an incident in a shared apartment where the defendant was not present, with no DNA, with a description that it was small and black. If the court asked me to provide a description of a gun that was more generic, I couldn't do so.
Why is it not admissible? What legal objection would you raise?
It's not relevant at this point, Judge.
What is required for evidence to be relevant?
It has a tendency to prove or disprove any element of the offense.
The defendant observed with a small black gun, and they find a small black gun in an area that he was around.
Several months later, so is any evidence of gun ownership at any point in time relevant in a case involving a gun? Or does it have to be attenuated to the crime? I think the best reason it's not relevant is given by the detective in this case, where they ask him, is there any indication whatsoever that this was the gun used in the crime? And he says, no, there's not. And that's a very clear question, and it's on page 298, where they ask, is there anything, you know, they're asking, any reason to give to the jury why this should be included in this crime? And he says, no, there's not.
Well, there's an argument that goes to weight rather than admissibility. Mm-hmm.
However, I think that the Commonwealth is bound by its own evidence. It can't rise above that, you know, quoting the famous Massey versus Firmstone. If they said there's nothing, this has nothing to do with this case, then they can't then say it's also relevant because it does have something to do with this case. I think that they're bound by that indication by the detective. So Your Honor can also rule in our favor if you find that it was not relevant. The third way is if you find that it's more prejudicial than probative. If the court does find relevancy, is it more prejudicial than probative? In this case, it is absolutely more prejudicial. The gun isn't even admitted into evidence. It's simply held up in front of the jury as a fear-mongering tactic.
I think a picture of the gun was admitted, wasn't it?
A picture was, yes, sir. Then at that point, they asked the detective to retrieve the gun. This is on page, I believe, about 283 at this point. And he holds it up and displays it for the jury.
Any objection?
Without any objection in the trial court at the time, Judge, but it is clearly used to be more prejudicial than probative, and that is the final way that you can find for us on the first point. Either by finding...
How can we decide whether it's more prejudicial than probative if the trial court didn't make that ruling one way or another at the outset?
I believe that you can, Judge, because this is applying the law to the facts, so it can be ruled de novo based upon the court's understanding of the record. So Your Honor can find for us in three ways in this first assignment of error. First, that it should have been ruled on in the motion in limine, which was improperly put to the side. Second, that it was not relevant, even if it had reached the merits. And third, that if it had reached the merits, it was more prejudicial than probative.
Can I ask you on your first point there?
Yes, sir.
Your argument is that under Rule 3A, colon, non, that it was fit under B2 rather than B1, right?
That's correct, sir.
So where was the objection made to the court at the time? No, this, you're wrong, Your Honor. This should have been, you should be ruling on this under B2, so you don't have to rule. It doesn't have to be filed ahead of time. You don't have to rule ahead of time. Where was that objection made?
It was properly brought before the court. The court said, I'm not going to entertain this motion. At that point, the only thing that could have been said would be to note my exception, that the issue was properly brought before the court and an incorrect ruling was made.
And you can't object then? Say, Your Honor, I object. I think it's under B2. You can't do this.
Well, if he says he's not considering, he states in there that I'm not going to consider arguments in this matter.
So you're saying it's so if it's a 518 problem for you, that it's really a good cause exception because he wouldn't let you argue it.
It says, and that's what he says, is that the motion will not be heard. So if the motion is not being heard, how do you, at that point, are you supposed to interject? So I understand you're not hearing, Judge, but I want to object to you not letting me speak.
I think you're doing it under B1 instead of B2.
At that point, Judge, when the court has made it clear that they're not going to entertain argument, I think that because the issue was brought properly in front of the court, it should be there. I guess the only thing that could be done would be to say, note my exception at this point.
But there's nothing to suggest that anything changed in terms of the admissibility of that weapon between the time the The court did not rule on the motion in a time that it was admitted without objection. I mean, if you'd stood up, or the trial attorney had stood up and said, Your Honor, I now want to renew my motion, this gun is not admissible because it's not relevant, then the trial court would have made the ruling.
I believe that would have been a great way to do it, Judge, but I don't believe it's the only way. The additional way to do it is to raise this before the court in a motion prior to trial. If it was brought before trial and then again brought in trial, that would certainly satisfy as well.
He didn't make any argument, though, as to why that motion needed to be resolved prior to trial. I mean, there wasn't anything like, well, Your Honor, then could you at least instruct the Commonwealth not to refer to the exhibit in opening statement or until such time as the court can rule on its admissibility? But that wasn't done. So the court's in the same posture, the case is in the same posture at the time the gun was admitted as it was prior to the beginning of trial.
I think the court then has to look at the motion and see whether it should have been one that was decided. And that's the standard in B that says it may be raised by the motion before trial. So the motion is contained on page 53 of the appendix. Everything that's stated in the motion is true. Nothing that is stated in there is false. There's no one can say this is the firearm that was used. In fact, it specifically indicated otherwise that it is not linked to this crime. So if Your Honor reads this motion, decides that it should have been ruled upon, then I think that at that point, the court made an error.
But the firearm was of the same basic size and color identified by the witness as being used in the robbery. The firearm was found in Hughes' residence at the time, same time as the stolen goods were found. How can that not be at least marginally relevant?
Well, it was because it's not indicated in the crime. I think that they're bound by that detective statement that it's not indicated in this crime. Again, the description is so vanilla that I can't, there's
sometimes
not anything
that's
else.
That's all you have in cases where people may not be gun experts and they're just talking about what they saw and they're pretty upset because the gun's, involved in the situation. So they're like, well, no, it was a black gun or it was a gray gun. That's all you have. So why doesn't that go, as Judge Decker noted, to the weight of the evidence as opposed to just simply being inadmissible?
If it goes to the weight, then that reaches my third argument, that it's more prejudicial than it is probative in this instance. I don't believe that this is a case where you have one of these naive persons. This is a person who was selling drugs. The alleged victim in this case was selling drugs, had an AK-47 in his residence. I don't think this is one of those persons who was caught unawares by the appearance of a gun.
Well, I just want to remind you, you're into rebuttal now. You may choose to proceed or reserve.
I would like to make one point regarding the sufficiency of the evidence, and then I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Regarding the armed burglary, Judge, there is no evidence that the weapon that was used in that case was actually one that was capable of producing deadly force. It is different than the standard that is used for firearm. The General Assembly uses different language, and the jury instruction, which is found on page, I believe it is 367, if I can refer to my notes. 367 distinguishes, it says that it actually has to be capable of producing deadly force, and quite a distinction from what can be used in armed robbery. That is why that is not sufficient evidence in this case, Judge. I'll reserve the rest of my time for my rebuttal, or I'll take questions from the court.
Thank you.
Good morning. Catherine Adolfo again on behalf of the Commonwealth. May it please the Court. It's important to note again what issue is actually being raised in the first assignment of error. The only issue raised in the first assignment of error is whether the trial court erred in refusing to consider the motion in limine.
Do you agree that the trial court did err in thinking that it had to be filed 7 days in advance?
I agree, Your Honor. But the defendant acquiesced in the trial court's determination that it needed to be filed 7 days in advance. She never articulated anywhere that this was a motion that could be raised at any time prior to the jury verdict. She never articulated that it fell under the B2 paragraph. In fact, when the court suggested that it was not timely, she said understood, and she said it not once, she said it twice. So the court had no opportunity to actually determine the issue which is raised in this first assignment of error, which is whether or not it was a timely filed motion.
So did the judge, even though the judge said it came too late, did the judge make an alternate ruling?
And the court did make an alternate ruling. That alternate ruling was not challenged in this assignment of error. It is not before this court. It is barred by Rule 5A:12. Even if it had been preserved or had been raised in the assignment of error, the circuit court's ruling was correct. As Your Honor has previously noted, the fact that a gun similar in description to the one used in the robbery was found in the defendant's home along with the proceeds of the robbery tends to show that the defendant actually committed the crime and used a gun in the commission of those offenses. The Commonwealth was not required to conclusively show that it was the firearm used. It only needed to show that it was intended to establish a fact at issue. As Your Honor also noted, the fact that this firearm came in at trial without objection further waives the defendant's argument with respect to this issue, because he had the opportunity to challenge the admission of the firearm evidence, and he did not do so.
Is that a procedural issue, or is it harmless error?
I'd suggest it's a procedural issue. But
just a withdrawal of the objection, a functional equivalent of withdraw the objection.
Correct, Your Honor. Just to address another point raised by the defendant, possession of a firearm alone is not inflammatory. It does not establish per se prejudice. As counsel was able to argue below, just because the defendant was found with a firearm in his home, that is not indicative that he committed these crimes. Counsel made the appropriate argument with respect to the relevancy of the firearm found in the defendant's home. And the court doesn't have any further questions. I've addressed the sufficiency argument now. This argument was also not preserved on appeal. The sufficiency of the evidence was only challenged generally in the motions to strike, in both the motion to strike and in the renewed motion to strike. Nowhere in the motions to strike did the defendant raise any of these specific arguments with respect to the sufficiency of the evidence. In a jury trial, these issues of law must be raised in a motion to strike, and
are you referring to his statement to us before he sat down about instruction number 17 with regard to whether the firearm that was utilized in the robbery was a deadly weapon?
Well, yes, Your Honor, but I'd suggest that every argument made in the brief is
so
not preserved.
They did do a motion to strike, it didn't make it clear that dealt with sufficiency at all, you mean? I'm not following your point.
The arguments at the motion to strike phase were just general arguments. The Commonwealth has failed to demonstrate, has failed to satisfy the elements. Nowhere did he say the Commonwealth has failed to establish that the defendant was actually the individual who committed these crimes. In neither the motion to strike nor the closing arguments did he raise the argument raised today, which is that the defendant didn't have the requisite intent at the time he opened the door, or that he possessed the firearm at the time they entered the home.
Mr. Delphia, this court used to require a because clause in an assignment of error. The evidence was insufficient because this element wasn't proven or that element wasn't proven. The Supreme Court has reversed us on that and said, no, all you have to say is the evidence was insufficient. Why doesn't that same rationale apply to a motion to strike such as this? Because the judge is presumed to know the law and presumed to know the elements of the offense.
Your Honor, the court in this, I'd say, especially with very specific law-based arguments, like there's no evidence that this was a firearm, that the firearm was possessed at the time you entered the home, the court had no opportunity to actually rule specificity on the objections that were being raised. The trial court can't be expected to make a defendant's arguments for him. There was no time for the circuit court judge to actually rule on the legal issues that are now being raised on appeal. And our case law says that defendants must raise with specificity at appropriate times the arguments. I point the court to the Carter case, which discusses, which granted that was a 1986 case. No, I'm sorry, Your Honor, that I note that I cited in the on brief the cases that state that it's not enough to raise general objections in a motion to strike. You must put the appropriate issues before the court and give the court the opportunity to rule on the legal arguments that you wish to preserve for appeal. And if the court has no further questions, I'd ask for you to affirm the trial.
In case we decide we need to get to the merits, can you answer my question on instruction number 17, the point that Mr. Whittle made before he sat down? Assume we're referring to the black gun and the gun that was held at the head of the victim here, Mr. Uribe, if I'm pronouncing that name correctly. Why is that instruction fatal? Or why is there a problem here if the gun is held to the head like that?
It's not fatal, and in fact, the officer testified that they found a gun at the scene, and the court was entitled to infer that the gun found in the defendant's home was the same firearm used at the time they entered the victim's homes.
And they're not referring to the AK-47 there, I assume.
No, that's the gun they stole, but
right.
They, I believe, the female co-defendant, Russo, testified that they entered the home with the firearm, and obviously the victim testified that a firearm was held on him throughout the attack, and the fact finder was entitled to infer that the defendants entered the home with that gun, which
is presumably a deadly weapon if it's a firearm.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you disagree that with opposing counsel that you don't have to prove that it's operable?
Certainly, with respect to use of a firearm, you don't need to prove that it's operable. Off the top of my head, Your Honor, I'm sorry, I don't
know. I think the instruction pertained to a deadly weapon, not a firearm.
I'd suggest that
burglary charge, it's breaking and entering while armed with a deadly weapon, which can be a baseball bat, a knife, a gun, crowbar.
I'd suggest that a metal object that appears to be a gun, even if it's not operable, can be deadly. It's sufficiently... you could hit someone with it or but in this case, I'd certainly suggest that it was before the jury whether or not the defendant entered the home with the firearm, and there was sufficient evidence to support a finding that the defendant entered the home with a firearm, with an operable firearm.
Well, or with a deadly weapon.
Or with a deadly weapon. I'd ask that the court affirm the decision of the circuit court. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Judge, I see I have limited time, so I'm going to get back to right where we left off.
We might give you a minute or so extra because we have hit you with a lot of questions.
Thank you, sir. I think it's a very important distinction between deadly weapon and firearm, simply because firearm does give the Commonwealth that broad use of, is it an operable weapon or is it something that's shaped to look like a firearm?
Well, don't you have a more basic problem because you didn't make that argument below? The motion to strike, as Mr. Delfia has mentioned, simply says, I believe that the Commonwealth evidence has fallen in the insufficiency category, and I don't believe they've proven their case beyond a reasonable doubt. There's no mention of what element of which offense had not been established.
I would have to rely on Your Honor's own rationale that the Supreme Court has said that a general insufficiency argument that's been raised.
Well, the flip side to that argument is that while you don't have to raise it in the assignment of error, you do have to address it in the written argument in your brief. So it is a little apples and oranges.
Well, and
5A12 instead of 5A18, I think, is the point. They reversed us on 5A12, but not on if it's not made below?
I think that at this point, the jury instructions, the elements, are all in front of the court. If someone says that they're insufficient to meet these elements, I think that is raising it sufficiently enough, especially given that there's a specific instruction on this. I would even go so far in this case to say that the ends of justice might require this, because there's nothing to demonstrate that this was a deadly weapon. It's as if the Commonwealth wants to have it both ways, that this is a small metal object, but it's also a deadly weapon, even though the small black object that was found in Mr. Hughes' home is not indicated in this crime, as testified by Detective Waddell. And one correction I want to make is there was no gun found on the scene of the crime here. The only purported gun to be on the scene of the crime that was recovered was the AK-47. The small black pistol was recovered at the Sheriff's Department of Ian Hughes several months later.
Mr. Whittle, I'd like to ask you the practical implication of your first assignment of error.
Yes, sir.
If we rule in your favor, would we effectively be telling trial courts that they must consider a last-second motion in limine even when you have a jury waiting in the box?
Yes, sir. I believe if it's properly noted. I think that the Supreme Court knows, it's presumed to know its own words as well. They set a 7-day standard for motions under 39A. They did not set the same standard under 39B, so I think
The Commonwealth can appeal under 39A, and the Commonwealth can't appeal under 39B, so there is a distinction there with a difference.
There is a distinction, sir, but the only thing that Mr. Hughes is asking for is a ruling.
Would this be in a different posture if the trial judge said, I need to see how this develops, as oftentimes trial judges will hold a motion in limine in abeyance until the evidence is actually offered at trial, and then the defense moves at that point in time? That would be a different scenario, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, it would. And
that's typically what happens.
That's how I've heard it as well.
Hour things.
Yes, Your Honor, the way that I've heard it done is they'll reserve, or they'll say denied at this point in time. You may renew your motion at an appropriate time, none of which was said in this case. It was not ruled upon. That is the error that we complain of in this point.
All right. Thank you very much for your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll greet counsel, then take up Mills versus